Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 5 in my deep dive on schizotypal personality disorder. Let's talk about treatment. So the first thing to consider is how do these individuals present in therapy in the first place? Because very rarely do they present with schizotypal. It's happened with me off the top of my head at least a couple times, but usually they present with other issues. For example, they might show up with depression or social anxiety, or worries about psychosis, or substance abuse problems, or dissociation, or they're unable to work because of their isolation, because of what they believe to be social anxiety, but it's not social anxiety, it's schizotypal. I mean, it's a form of social anxiety, I suppose. Or sometimes they're forced into therapy by others, by family, maybe even by their workplace, because of what these other individuals are observing. You know, like a 20-year-old kid who still lives at home and never comes out of her room, and the parents are like, you got to go to therapy, that kind of thing. So that's one thing to think about, and very important, because identifying these individuals as quickly as possible is very important. And you might be able to use one of those questionnaires if you can count on the client answering accurately and honestly, because it'll get at that. But basically, if you ever come across a client who presents with, you know, one of those things, and they also in session report or come across as extremely shy, like just unrelentingly shy and quiet and worried, and it seemingly never goes away, and might even be age inappropriate. Not everyone with schizotypal is like this, but a lot of the individual schizotypal that I treated, it was so strange the way that they presented, the way that they talked, the way that they acted. It was just an overwhelming, interesting, notable experience, you know, just very odd. And then the shyness as an adult, you know, you'd have a 40-year-old man who would just be so shy. And I remember one of the first schizotypal people I treated, they presented this way, and I figured, well, they're never coming back because they hate me. I mean, they don't want to talk to me. You know, I don't know what's going on here, but I'm never going to see this person again. And then they just kept coming back, and session after session after session, I just thought, what is happening here? Like, I don't understand what's going on. Like, so that's one sign. Having said that, there are plenty of people who suffer from schizotypal who don't present with shyness in session. They might not even be particularly shy. So I don't know. It's just another thing. I think it just points to an importance of waiting before you label and before you conceptualize, you know, having a lot of, particularly in the beginning, a lot of question marks and continuing to inquire to try to triangulate various different things, illuminate different experiences that the clients might not be present. Because it'd be very easy to find someone with schizotypal, the way they present and their own self-awareness, you know, because a lot of diagnosing depends on self-awareness of the client, that, you know, one particular brand of schizotypal that you'd say, okay, that person suffers from major depression and social anxiety, and just move forward with that. And you might think, oh, they're a little odd as well. Maybe they're on the autism spectrum, can't really tell right now. And then you just move forward and you just never re-ask that question. You know, you never visit the question again. It's like, well, am I looking at something? So it's just always important to always iterate your conceptualization and continue to assess. Because with all personality disorders, it takes a long time to get, especially again with schizotypal. And this, someone presents very quintessentially, and it's at the front of your mind. Okay, so treatment. Well, first off, let's talk about medication because it's easy to get out of the way here. There's not a lot of evidence that medication helps, particularly in my opinion, for the personality disorder version. For mild psychosis, for mild schizophrenia version of schizotypal, I'm guessing that it can help with those individuals. So often the medications that will be prescribed most often are antipsychotics, in my experience, and definitely worth a try for sure, particularly if the individual has pronounced mild hallucinations, you know, mild issues there, and particularly if those issues are interfering with their life, right? But, you know, a lot of the mild hallucinations and experiences that we talked about earlier and heard from people reporting, they weren't necessarily going to interfere with their life. You know what I mean? So it's just a matter of balancing it out. But I don't want to give the impression that you shouldn't recommend that they have a consultation with a prescriber, because it's definitely worth a try, like I said, because, you know, there could be some benefit to it. But for the personality disorder version of schizotypal, you're just putting a Band-Aid on something and maybe getting some relief. Now, of course, there are comorbid disorders like depression or anxiety that absolutely could respond more likely to medications, antidepressants, anxieties, anxiolytics. So those should also be pursued, of course. But with the personality at its core, the medication isn't going to work, and the evidence is pointing in that direction. Okay, so let's talk about psychotherapy. What does the research show? Well, there are a few protocols that seem to show evidence that they can reduce symptoms of schizotypal. Cognitive behavioral therapy, of course, because it's frequently it's going to help a lot of people with a variety of issues. Metacognitive therapy, supportive therapy. Supportive therapy is basically an umbrella for therapies that don't involve a protocol like CBT or some sort of psychodynamic therapy. It's listening, it's reflecting, it's providing empathy, that kind of thing. Also, group therapy can help people with schizotypal for obvious reasons, because it gets them to interact with other people. Social skills groups can help as well. But in my experience, what I do is kind of a complicated thing. The first thing that I'm really trying to establish is a bond with this individual. And it's really important with any personality disorder, because it is so transference heavy, that it's critical that I spend a lot of time trying to bond, trying to exude empathy and warmth and safety, and proving to them that I'm open to their experience, that I'm not going to judge them and say, oh my God, you're so crazy, because they probably get that a lot. They also probably get a lot of rejection from new people socially, because they do present as odd a lot of times, the way they talk, the way they walk. So I want to be very, very warm and very accepting and very caring. Similar to the way, and this is a good mindset for some of these individuals, is to really try to see them as young children. When you have a four-year-old that enters therapy with you, you know, you're pretty sure the four-year-old is scared of you, is needing a lot of care, is needing a lot of reassurance. You want to be extremely safe with these individuals. And so people with schizotypal are sometimes present this way, you know, not always, but I just really want to make sure that's established, because they could go home after a few sessions or one session and have a ton of paranoia and suspiciousness about me, especially because it could be a highly stressful situation for them and their symptoms are going to increase. And I'll never see him again if they believe that I'm trying to kill them, which some people with schizotypal will literally believe. And the more I can prove that right off the bat that that's not the case, the more likelihood that they're going to sustain in therapy. And also it is the beginning of the corrective experience for them. The second thing that I do is I try desperately to keep them in the world. Not everyone with schizotypal is like this, but the acute severe cases that I worked with, they were either on the precipice or sometimes even already crossed the threshold into complete isolation, because their disorder will be pushing them in that direction, away from other people, away from work, away from family, away from friends, away from the public. And the more isolated they become, the worse their disorder can become, because they become comfortable in their isolation, and the longer they go without interacting with others, the more they become paranoid and suspicious about people. You know, they need constant reminders and evidence that other people are not out to get them. And so I would sometimes have to create a wraparound service with the psychiatrist and the family and the maybe even the place of work, the school, and we all work together to prevent this individual becoming fully isolated. Like one of the things that I remember doing with one client is I would be in contact with the school to make sure that the teachers and the other students, I can't remember exactly how the conversation went, but I wanted everyone to understand that the weird behavior, even because as I said, in other cases, sometimes these individuals can get quite hostile, can be quite aggressive. not always, but they can be off-putting at the very least because of their suspicion of other people and their paranoia. And they can be problematic, not just shy, but they can even attack you unfairly, strangely, right? And it can be scary or it can be hurtful or something like this, you know, not physically usually, but certainly can be, but usually it's more verbal or emotional vibe of hostility. And when that happens, there's a natural tendency for people to reject you or to punish you or something. And I would have to work with that system so that that was lessened, if not completely eliminated, because the more of that reactivity to the schizotypal individual that happens, the more likelihood they're going to be suspicious, the more likelihood they're going to be hostile, the more likelihood they're going to isolate. And so I would have to work with anyone and with everyone. And again, I would, of course, I would have consent from the client to be able to talk to these people, which could sometimes be difficult to get from the schizotypal client, which is another thing you'd really have to work on and really walk them through exactly, maybe even have them there when you talk to people so that it doesn't increase suspiciousness. This is a sort of a side note that is important for you clinicians out there. And maybe you already know this, but when we as clinicians confer or consult with other clinicians about a particular client, we know that we're trying to do well by our client. For example, if I have a client that has, say I have a couple, two individuals that I'm seeing, and each of them has their own individual therapist. And so I will call their individual therapists and talk with them, talk with the individual therapist to confer, make sure we're on the same page, get some exchange of information. And for me and the other therapists, we understand that this is actually going to enhance the treatment of these individuals, right? It's going to, at the very least, it could enhance and is important to do. So we're not pulling different directions, blah, blah. And so I would do that. And then sometimes I would get reactions from, for example, a couple or one individual in the couple that they might be like, wait, what did you say to my individual therapist? Like, what did you share with them? What did they tell you? And there's this worry that somehow, I think people have traumas around people conferring about them behind their back. They feel like it's behind their back. It's not behind their back though. You know, it's just a part of treatment, right? But if you were talked about behind your back, maybe your parents or kids at school or something, you will have a paranoia around that. And so it's important to soothe that worry prior to doing the consultation with all clients, but again, particularly with schizotypal, right? All right, so I would work really hard on really trying to keep them connected in the world. And for therapists who are at the, you know, the sort of the tip of the spear, like, because usually the psychotherapist is that person, that identified person that knows the client the best, it's probably on them the responsibility to coordinate care and to coordinate this wraparound service. Okay. The third thing that I do is to work on cognitions, cognitive therapy, narrative therapy, schema therapy. All these things are related in my book to differentiation therapy, Bowenian therapy, are all part of this camp of activity that I would do with a client, which is to challenge and to scrutinize, to evaluate the way that they see the world. They might have a coworker that they believe is out to get them, out to kill them. Like we heard from that one individual in the previous chapter talking about how the neighbors will give him food, when he's sick or something. And he, the individual, the person with schizotypal, it is fairly convinced that the neighbors are trying to poison him. And so we would want to look at that. Now, I wouldn't force the client to eat the food because that could be overwhelming in terms of the exposure, right? But without any evaluation from the client on these notions, these intrusive thoughts, the intrusive thoughts will just run rampant. So there has to be some pushback, some question mark, some edit in their brain in terms of like, well, is this really rational? Is it likely? Is this really how I want to live my life? It takes a long time, but this is important because they need to be their higher mind or their conscious mind or their non-schizotypal mind or whatever you want to call it needs to be bolstered, needs to be strong to, at the very least, raise question marks. The fourth and last thing, and more long-term thing that I do, of course, is to provide corrective experiences. And the experience and the vibe often, not always, is one of early childhood. And I'm talking early, early childhood, like one-year-old kind of corrective experiences with people, meaning that I will try to hold in my mind, if they were 1 or 2 years old and talking like this in a 1 or 2 year old sort of way, what would I say to them? And with 1 or 2 year olds, what we want to do with them is to help them feel safe, to enter their world and live in their world. You know, you have a 2 year old, for example, comes into your office and wants to play with puppets or wants to play with toys, and you might not even understand what they're saying half the time. You know, they got the dinosaurs and they're like, wee, wee. And you can't even really communicate with the individual in a detailed way because of, speech issues or just not really understanding each other. You don't understand what they're getting at half the time because they're kind of in their own imagination world. And that is, although it looks different because, of course, in all likelihood, they speak relatively well as an adult. But the vibe, the feeling that you have is of that, and it orients me towards the things that I think are important to orient towards, which is safety and empathy and care and also mirroring of emotions. Remember that my model of how this develops has to do with the neglect and has to do with the lack of development of understanding of their own emotions, understanding emotions in general, and it, you know, really screws things up in terms of how they express emotions, how they take care of themselves, how they know what they need, how they understand others, how they can empathize with others. You know, understanding emotions are very important, and we can't assume that everyone has that understanding. And so with these, and it's not always the case, but a lot of the times with schizotypal, I would spend a lot of time with that. It can be very frustrating, though, and can be very boring, because for you out there, for all you out there who have worked with young children in therapy, you know that a lot of kids, not always, of course, it can be kind of a grind in therapy, because there's not a lot of variance and there's not a lot of excitement in a session with a young child. There can be, for sure, but it can be kind of a slog. And with people with schizotypal, it could be that way sometimes. You know, like one client, I think I was talking about her before, she would stare at the floor and whisper. And I would have to pull my chair as close as humanly and ethically possible so that I would lower my head to her level so that I could barely hear what she was saying to me because of how scared she was, how shy she was, how delusionally suspicious she was of everyone, and how shut down she was. And so she's bent over on my couch. She's staring at the ground. She's got her hands over her face and just staring straight down at the ground. I can't even see her face, you know, right? Because I could only see the top of her head. When I say whisper, it doesn't even, there's got to be a different word for what's quieter than a whisper. That's what she was doing. And so that's arduous as a therapist. And we're talking, that's what she presented for every session for months. So I'd get real close to her and I would have to ask very simple questions, but I had a ton of compassion. You know, once I figured out what was going on, once she let me into her world, which was, you know, a typical schizotypal world, I had a lot of compassion, a lot of empathy. You know, it was a lot of suffering. It was pretty much 24/7 suffering. And I was working real hard to keep her in the world. And she was always at risk of completely isolating and going down that rabbit hole. And so I would be there with her, but it was laborious. I would ask a question. I would usually have to ask a very simple question. And she might not respond, or she might respond so quietly, I can't understand what she said. Or she might respond in this very odd way, or she might respond in this very simplistic way. And just a question that, say, I would ask another client where I'm just like, how was your week? And then they talk for 15 minutes and I listen, right? And I provide empathy that way. That's a lot easier for me and a lot more interesting to me than asking a client from various different angles, how do you feel right now? What emotion are you feeling right now? Or how was your week or something like that? And after 50, 55 minutes of a session, getting a very vague answer overall, right? So it requires a ton of patience. And if you were working with a two-year-old who had been abused, you would get it, right? You'd be like, well, you know, the kid's two and they're not super verbal and they're terrified, they've been abused. So the session's going to be laborious. It's going to be arduous. It's not going to be a back and forth. It's not going to be very fluid. And with some people with schizotypal, it can be this way. Having said all that, there are plenty of people with schizotypal, like that one internet YouTube video individual, who can speak pretty clearly and freely about their issue, particularly if they've been through some therapy already. There's different presentations. So I don't want to characterize everyone with schizotypal that way, but it can be quite arduous. And if you enter into a mindset of this is not a 40-year-old man, this is a 2-year-old boy, I think it makes it, it makes it tolerable. It makes it so much easier. You know, when you're working with a 2-year-old and it's very labor intensive from the therapist, it makes it so much easier because it's like, well, you know, it's a kid, what are you going to do? Whereas if you have this assumption that this 4-year-old, very quiet, schizotypal individual is purposely not answering questions, then it can feel frustrating. Like, why aren't you talking? But it could be a very clear manifestation of their symptoms. Again, not everyone's schizotypal is like this. So again, I try to create a very open space where they can explore their imagination, where they can tell me about how they think they're Spider-Man or they think the trees are talking to them. And I'm not judging them. I'm truly entering their world. You know, there's a good portion of my brain that is like, well, that's not likely, but that's not important for the corrective experience portion or effort in therapy. It's important for me, like with a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old, to just enter their world and be client-centered and, oh, what's that like? And as long as it's not something like the trees are telling me to kill people and they told me to get the gun in the closet, as long as there's not a safety issue, which there usually isn't a safety issue, then you will just enter the world. You know, it's like, what are the trees trying to tell you? What do you think they want to do? And be in their world, because when you do that, so here's the key to the corrective experience is you have to counteract. There's two things you have to do. One is you have to massively counteract the notion that everyone is worthy of suspicion, that everyone is worthy of their paranoia. So you have to, like with borderline, you have to prove that you're not going to abandon them or betray them. With schizotypal individuals, you have to prove that you are not conspiring against them, that you're not trying to kill them, that you're not secretly hating them, that you fully accept them and are very safe and have zero motivation to harm them in any way, shape, or form. And better yet, not only that, but you actually truly care about them, right? So that's one prong to the corrective experience. The other is you have to reparent the child, in all likelihood, if it does generate from that early childhood neglect, by attuning to their emotions, attuning to their 2-year-old primitive versions of emotions. To a 2-year-old, you don't ask them, how do you feel? And like, oh, interesting. Like, what are your cognitions? You can't be intellectual. You can't be complicated. You have to be very simple. You'd be like, oh, okay, you're very. So for example, with some schizotypal clients, I might for months reflect to them that they appear scared to me. I might talk to them and just constantly throughout every session and, for months and along, many, many sessions, I'm basically saying, you appear afraid to me. That's what I'm observing. Or you're talking very quietly, which is an expression to me. I don't know, but it looks like you're afraid to take up space or you're afraid to speak up because you're worried that I'm going to do something to you, or you're worried that something bad is going to happen. And even if the client doesn't respond or denies that or something. This is important for people when they're young, but if they don't get that when they're young, then you have to do it when they're old. You have to mirror to them. You have to, because they might not understand. For a two-year-old, when they're in the midst of their terror, right? So let's say you go to the mall and the two-year-old is afraid of strangers, and suddenly you as the parent run into a bunch of people, like say a group of seven people from work and their kids, and you're like, oh, and then all of a sudden all seven of those people turn to the two-year-old child and is like, oh, and this is Jenny. Oh, look at cute little Jenny. Is that a hat you have? The way that people will interact with a two-year-old. And imagine, not every two-year-old, but many will just be overwhelmed. They'll just be like, oh my God, everyone's looking at me and asking me questions. And, it's normal to be that way. And for you as a parent in that moment, you don't expect anything different. You also will try to protect them. You'll let them off the hook. You'll be like, oh, well, she's shy. Or you might say the seven people wander off and you see some residual emotion in your child, and you don't have this long, complicated conversation with the two-year-old. You just be like, hey, honey, I know that was scary, that a bunch of people suddenly asked you a bunch of questions. That was a lot to take in. And your two-year-old child might say something like, no, I'm not afraid, or whatever. Or they might just ignore the statement or look away from you or something. And you're doing good. That's all you can expect from a two-year-old. Well, a similar approach might be helpful as a corrective experience to people with schizotypal. Not always. There are plenty of people with schizotypal who have a fair amount of emotional awareness. Maybe it's like a spectrum thing. The more severe schizotypal individuals in all likelihood will need this kind of corrective experience, this kind of mirroring. So that's another thing to think about. But again, you tailor it to the individual. Some people with schizotypal might have a really hard time identifying their sadness and their pain and their hurt, but they might have a really easy time identifying their fear or something. It just depends. But the key is that with the personality disorder version, the one that emerges from early childhood relational traumas, and usually it's a result of neglect, you are trying to counteract that. And you will evaluate, if you can, get at what the client thinks of you. Hopefully you can draw that out of them. Like, a typical course progression of this is the client says, I think my neighbors are trying to kill me, or I think my coworkers are trying to get me fired. And there's no evidence that that's true. You might even know it's not true because you're working in the wraparound service. And you work on that and you try to help them evaluate that and ask some questions as to whether or not that's rational. And then eventually you want to get to, well, what do you think about me? Do you think I'm trying to kill you? Do you think I'm trying to conspire against you? Because in all likelihood, they've transferred to you and they apply their disorder to you, of course. And then you want to start working in therapy, in the relationship, the therapeutic relationship, because it's there, right? You don't have to wonder about that coworker. You don't have to wonder about that stranger that the client is talking about. Your client's talking about you, and you know what you feel. And you can, in the moment, counteract that through just disclosing to a client how you feel and what you want and the complexity of what's going on inside of you emotionally and cognitively. So, and you could also just exhibit care right then and there, right? And I say the complexity because when you are doing this kind of work, I'll just speak from myself. When I do this kind of work, I'm always trying to avoid coming across as someone that can't be trusted. I'm trying to come across as a trustworthy individual. And what I have found, not only for myself and trusting others, but trying to gain other people's trust, is if you have elaborate enough answers. So for example, say I'm working with someone with schizotypal and they disclose to me, they finally tell me, therapist Kirk, I do think that you are out to get me. Like when you call my psychiatrist, I have wondered if you are trying to get my psychiatrist to poison me. Okay, something like that. That, a simple response to that would be, no, I'm not. Or just some kind of longer version of that. It's like, no, I would never do that. That would never occur to me. I'm glad you told me, but
why would I want to poison you? So, you know, you talk along that, in that realm of, no, I'm not trying to poison you. And that would gain potentially some trust. But to me, what would gain even more trust is if I told the client, but if you want to be, if you want to know the full story, although I've never wanted to try to poison you, I've never wanted to harm you, I have had some negative feelings about you at times, never to the point where I want to reject you or I want to get rid of you or kill you. I mean, that's just not even, I've never wanted to do that to anyone. But if you want to know my negative thoughts about you, they have been like that one time when you came to session and you just refused to talk for a half an hour. Like, it felt rejecting to me. It felt very discouraging and frustrating. And I was frustrated in that moment. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, there was a point there at minute 25 of you not talking to me that I wondered if maybe I was not the right therapist for you. And I started wondering if I should refer you somewhere else. Ultimately, I knew that this was just the progression of therapy with you and your disorder. But, you know, I'm not going to lie, there's some negativity there. Okay, so to present that to the client, to me, that makes me more trustworthy, because I'm not saying to the client there's an absence of negativity. What I'm saying is I have a complex, multifaceted reaction to you, but and let me tell you all the aspects of that. And I definitely have never wanted to kill you or harm you in any sort of way. And I've never talked to your psychiatrist about trying to poison you. So when you give more detail, it makes the claim more believable that you're trying to get. You know, I don't necessarily need the client to know that I was frustrated in that 30 minutes of silence from the client. But if I give that detail, it'll make the key point I'm trying to make more trustworthy, right? That I know would never call your psychiatrist and tell them to kill you. You know what I mean? So, and this is a good principle to follow with all self-disclosure, even if you're not a therapist, even if you're just talking to your spouse, right? Your spouse is like, so have you ever had a bad time when we were having sex or something? And if you're, and they're paranoid that you never want to have sex with them or something, that you're not attracted to them. And if you're just like, no, I've never had a negative, I've never, you know, not wanted to have sex with you in the moment. And let's say that's true. But if you say, well, but, you know, there's some nuance there. You know, there's some times when, you know, I'm not particularly in the mood, but I get into the mood, or I'm only halfway in the mood, or there are some times when, I don't know, I'm just sort of tired, or my body just isn't working quite right. My hormones are off or something, that it's harder for me to feel as pleasurable as I do in other moments. But so I'm not going to say it's always this euphoric, wonderful experience. It's always worth it to me. You know, you give the full story depending on the individual, depending on the relationship. To me, it is helpful to know all that information, to know the nuance between people, close people. But also, in my book, it makes the individual more believable. You know, you hear me talk about this sometimes when I will critique individuals' apologies. When people give very simplistic apologies, like they'll say, you know, I'm sorry that I did that. I take full responsibility. And the reason why I did it, it has to do with issues in my life or something like that. And okay, it's great. It's a good topic sentence, but it, you could just be saying that. Whereas if you go into full detail about how you're sorry or why you're sorry or how you felt or what you think other people are going through, the full story as to what you think is wrong with your personality or the, you know, particular personality trait or tendency that you have, where did it begin? What do you think about it? How else does it shoot you in the foot? You talk about the full thing, it makes it much more convincing that you truly are sorry and you truly have thought about it and you truly are going to work on it. You know, now maybe I'm just biased in that direction because I'm a talkative yammerer to begin with. All right, let's conclude with your emails. Patron Amanda from Los Angeles wrote in and said, you mentioned you're doing an episode on schizotypy. For my research paper at Antioch, LA last quarter, by the way, we have a branch in Los Angeles, Antioch, For my research paper at Antioch, LA last quarter, I actually looked into whether there are effective therapies for people with conspiracy beliefs, because like you and Berto, I'm shocked by the prevalence of QAnon, and that led me to schizotypy. It seems like an understudied area of therapy, but metacognitive reflective insight therapy is one therapy that sounds promising and doesn't seem well known. Ultimately, it seems like getting schizotypal individuals to actually go to therapy and stay in it may be the biggest challenge. I wanted to send you my list of references in hopes that you might find them interesting. End of email. Yeah, so thanks, Amanda, for sending me all of these. I'll check those out later. So yeah, thanks. Yeah, metacognitive reflective insight therapy, I don't know the model extremely well, but from what I understand, the version of therapy that I do is at least in part similar to that form of therapy. It's more manualized, more systematic way of looking at how these you're trying to help the individual to evaluate the way that they think and the way that they look at things. And yeah, so that's the cognitive, what I call the cognitive therapy portion of my approach. All right, this next email is from upper tier patron Kim from Arizona. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Hanna. This is Kim from Arizona. Good old Kim from Arizona. Thank you for reading my question the other day regarding schizotypal personality disorder. You invited me to write you with details about myself to have more information for a potential deep dive on schizotypal personality disorder. By the way, if you ever read it and use it for research, you can do so. No worries. Here's a basic bio of me. I'm 34 years old, cisgender female, demi-heterosexual, occasionally sex repulsed. I'm still a virgin. And by the way, good job on the asexual deep dive. That was spot on. I work full-time as a software engineer, and I was also a weird kid who had no friends. My psychological team have told me that I have schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, body dysmorphia, an eating disorder, complex PTSD, otherwise specified dissociative disorder, Asperger's syndrome, schizotypal personality disorder, and ADHD. All right, just chiming in here. So yeah, it's pretty common, not universally, of course, but a lot of people with schizotypal will have a number of diagnoses and labels, either because the clinical picture isn't very clear and the individual has been diagnosed over the years with various different things, trying to label the symptoms of schizotypal, because schizotypal can look like a lot of different things, or the individual actually does suffer from a lot of different issues as a result of genetics and experience. But just evaluating some of the categories here, we have Kim is saying that she's been diagnosed with schizoaffective bipolar and schizotypal. So that doesn't look right to me. I mean, obviously, it could be that the individual, I would have a hard time seeing anyone legitimately qualifying for schizoaffective and bipolar at the same time. Seems like I would just pick one. And I'd have to be pretty convinced that the schizotypal wasn't just presenting like schizoaffective. You know, bipolar and schizotypal are pretty different, but so that's that category. And then we have body dysmorphia, eating disorder. Of course, those are comorbid, often do co-occur with schizotypal, I think because of similar genesis regarding early childhood trauma. We have complex PTSD, which is evidence that there's a lot of trauma in Kim's life. Otherwise specified dissociative disorder. I will often use this label for people. There's a lot of people with dissociation who don't fit neatly into any of the labels in the DSM. And so I don't know, Kim, what sort of dissociation you have, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a version that I often see where the individual essentially just checks out when there is threat, when there are reminders of the complex PTSD triggers that you've had. And so that experience isn't neatly subsumed under a label in DSM in the dissociative chapter. And then we also have Asperger's syndrome or autism spectrum disorder. And you also have schizotypal. I'm guessing that the Asperger's and the schizotypal are two names trying to get at what they were seeing in you. So I'm guessing that in reality you have one or the other, or it's better to conceptualize you as such. Could someone be on autism spectrum and have schizotypal? Yes, I've been over that already. ADHD often is comorbid with schizotypal for a variety of reasons. Also, one could exhibit all the signs of ADHD, but not actually legitimately have. Like, one of the ways to figure this out is if you provide, say, 5 years of effective treatment for schizotypal and the ADHD symptoms goes away, then you can conceptualize it as, well, the ADHD symptoms were just an outgrowth of the suffering of schizotypal. But, it's hard to know. Okay, Kim goes on to describe her psychiatric history. It's pretty detailed, and I want to thank Kim for providing this, because I think it is a pretty good story of someone who has schizotypal, a common scenario. Of course, it's not universal, but some details in here look very familiar. For example, you say age 10, you were placed on a 5150 hold for writing suicidal intentions in a notebook, and it seemed to resolve on its own a few days later. So having suicidal intentions at age 10 is, it happens, but it's rare. It's on the rare side of things. And then you say it seemed to resolve on its own a few days later. Okay, hard to know exactly what that means, if you were actually intending on killing yourself or if it was just a fantasy or some kind of weird thought you're having at the time. That happens sometimes. Age 14, first depressive episode occurred freshman year in high school, started failing math, prescribed antidepressants, began seeing a talk therapist, which was almost completely unhelpful. Just chiming in here. Yeah, trying to provide therapy for a 14-year-old that might not want to be in therapy, because I'm guessing that was the case. I'm guessing that, you started failing math, your parents got concerned, the school got concerned, you got evaluated, depression, prescription, they're like, you should go to therapy, it's a common thing. Plus, if the suspiciousness is there, which you haven't gone into, then you're going to be suspicious of a random therapist. I mean, 14-year-olds are suspicious anyway, in general. But so hard to know what the details are there. Age 17, started taking stimulants junior year because I couldn't concentrate, had poor mood. I'm guessing that you were diagnosed with ADHD at the time, which is common. Age 20, depressive episode junior year in college. In the course of one semester, I went from effortlessly getting A's and B's to failing every class, lost my ability to read, write, dress myself, walk long distances, had to medically withdraw from college for a semester and re-enter after completing a semester at community college. Tried taking Adderall for concentration, but it caused me to hear screaming in my head and strange metallic sounds. Doctors were not concerned. Okay, so this is a common story for people with schizotypal and also with psychosis, with schizoaffective and psychotic bipolar and schizophrenia, in that the first major signs of the disorder will emerge around age 20, give or take a few years. And so you talk about how school is really easy for you, you're getting A's and B's, and then all of a sudden, boom, you lost your ability to read, write, dress yourself, walk long distances. You took Adderall to try to help with it, but it caused you to hear screaming in your head, and you heard strange metallic, started to hallucinate, and also that doctors were not concerned, which is highly problematic. I mean, if you reported to them that you were hearing screaming in your head for any reason, that should absolutely provoke a psychiatric consultation, which it sounds like, or at least a psychiatric consultation with someone that knew what they were doing. I don't know. So I'm sorry you went through that. But that doesn't sound very pleasant. Age 25, started antidepressants again, put me into a mild hypomanic episode. So we're starting to look at potential bipolar here, or schizoaffective. Age 30, I had a psychotic break. I had quit my job and moved across the country to go to a 3-month-long coding boot camp with only a limited amount of savings, with the expectation. Okay, so what Kim is saying is, because of mania, probably, it's like, I'm going to quit my job, move cross country, and I'm going to get this wonderful job, and everything's going to be great. And she goes on, I experienced a bad case of food poisoning and wound up in the hospital for a weekend before the program began. The next day, I walked into a thrift store perfectly fine. Within a few minutes, I inexplicably felt extremely paranoid that the people around me were watching me, wanting to harm me. I was restless, racing, thoughts, panicky. My personality changed very quickly within a few weeks. Going on here, she says, I had wildly fluctuating mood swings. At the most extreme, I could be perfectly fine and 30 seconds later be hysterically crying and have no idea why and had not seen it coming at all. Very inconvenient in a classroom setting. I could be extremely euphoric for a few hours in the morning and be suicidally depressed later on in the day. Just chiming in here. Yeah, I mean, that's starting to sound like it's affective and or bipolar. It's not a sign of schizotypal. I mean, it could be an outgrowth of it, but it's sounding like quintessential mood disorder there. Became sexually attracted to one of my classmates. I had beliefs that he was able to read my thoughts and that I could transmit thoughts and feelings to him. The doctor said I had bipolar and gave me mood stabilizers. After my psychotic break, I finally found a decent doctor who diagnosed me with having schizoaffective disorder instead of bipolar. I was given antipsychotics instead of mood stabilizers. They only seemed to help minimally the mood stabilizers. I began EMDR therapy, and the word psychosis started being used regularly to describe my experiences. I was also diagnosed with celiac disease and began a celiac standard gluten-free diet. In the summer of 2020, after a few months of living in the pandemic where I could only cook for myself, I was able to get my gluten-free diet together. I stopped drinking excessive amounts of caffeine because I couldn't go to Starbucks. My psychosis and mood fluctuations basically went away in a matter of a week or so. I cautiously stopped taking psychiatric medications and have not taken them since. Since then, I only experience psychosis if I dabble with mind-altering substances like caffeine, alcohol, or marijuana, or benzos. So just chime in here. Well, Kim, I hope that you're talking with your prescribers about going off your meds. It's a classic schizoaffective or bipolar thing to do, to go off one's meds and in a way that is not responsible or very safe. So I'll assume that you're talking with your prescribers about that. But I will say that I have heard a number of cases, and it's well understood in terms of the biology, that celiac disease is not diagnosed enough, not detected enough, because gluten is so ubiquitous in our diet, right? And there are thoughts that there have, celiac disease and gluten sensitivity has been present within the human race forever, or for at least a long time. But in the past, people would just suffer because the connection wasn't necessarily known or made that it had to do with gluten, had to do with eating those kinds of foods. And not only can you have digestive issues, obviously, from celiac, but you can absolutely have psychiatric issues, or at the very least, it can massively exacerbate something. So there's a possible conceptualization based on what you are presenting here. And of course, I can't know based on this brief description, and I would talk with your prescribers, and maybe you're already getting at this, that you had a genetic disposition for psychosis, and without gluten, you never would have had any kind of symptoms, or they would have been minimal or something, and also mood fluctuations with schizoaffective. But with celiac disease, which has to do with the gut, and we fully understand now that the mind gut, the brain gut is one system. I mean, our whole body is one system, but our gut is very critical in our moods and in our brain functioning and in a lot of things having to do with our personalities and symptoms and stuff. So it's possible that the aggravation of the gluten in your system was pushing you over the edge into symptomology. And with a gluten-free diet, you might not need meds. Of course, talk with your prescribers about that. But I have heard other cases like that before. I think it's emerging as a pretty well-known phenomenon. But don't quote me on that, because I'm not a biologist. I'm not a physician. I'm just observing that field from a neighboring discipline. So, but I have heard of things like that before. All right. So Kim goes on to describe what she's calling features of my psychosis, she says. I have believed that I am an alien from outer space, not a human. I have been sentenced to a lifetime, and that I have been sentenced to a lifetime on Earth as a punishment for some form of transgression. I have traveled to Area 51 before hoping that a spaceship would come to take me away, but it never happened. I bought a t-shirt that says, I found my people at Area 51, which is a joke to other people, but was pretty literal for me. So just jam me in here. That sounds pretty classic psychosis. And I wouldn't care if I heard that from someone, I wouldn't think we were talking about schizotypal. I think we're talking about some form of full-blown psychosis. For 2 years, I believed every single day I went to work that I was going to be fired that day. I was absolutely terrified of my boss, all the while getting very positive performance reviews and promotions. Just chiming in here. Yeah, that sounds like it could be in the category of schizotypal, but hearing that first bit about the alien, I would categorize this as an outgrowth of whatever sort of the schizoaffective you were diagnosed with. I have encountered angels, and by the way, I'm just talking about ways of conceptualizing. I'm not saying that I'm not diagnosing you, Kim, one, because I haven't assessed you, but if I heard those things, this is how I would start to categorize them in my mind, you know what I mean? Because it would help with treatment. Because the treatment of schizoaffective or bipolar or schizophrenia psychosis is, as I've been talking about, really quite different than treating someone with a personality disorder. Going on, I have encountered angels or other entities being present in a room with me, usually when I have been distressed. I don't see them, but I have an image of them, if that makes any sense. And that's fairly rare. Just chiming in here. Yeah, so that starts to sound more like schizotypal. But again, if I hear about the other aspects of your symptoms, then I'm just going to say, well, you know, this is just kind of a mild hallucination within schizoaffective. I have heard voices in my head telling me that I am fucking stupid, and that's fairly rare. Just chiming in here. Yeah, that's pretty classic hallucination involved in psychosis. It's really unfortunate that a lot of psychotic hallucinations of voices are persecutory, meaning that the voices will say you're dumb, you're stupid, you're ridiculous, everyone hates you, you're a complete joke. People will report hearing a particular kind of voice, right? Like, you know, they'll say, I have this one voice that is this, it's like an old grandma from the 1960s. Yeah, they're very specific. And the language that these voices will use, just, you know, it's just, and there are all sorts of models for understanding as to why these things happen. And there appear to be cultural differences where hallucinations of voices in other cultures might not be as persecutory as Americans with persecutory hallucination voices. It's not really my area, but yeah, that sounds pretty classic psychosis there. I feel extremely claustrophobic in people. I feel extremely claustrophobic in people and can't stand people being close to me, even when most people might not think they are being very close to me. My favorite symptom is the delusions of grandeur. I catch myself believing that I'm a famous celebrity with millions of dollars and a lot of power, but it's not true. Just chiming in here. Yeah, that sounds pretty classic, either psychosis and or manic psychosis or mania. Pretty common with schizoaffective. I can be completely fine after having a good day, come home, and within 30 seconds have my mood completely plummet to the point where I have to curl up in a fetal position and cry to prevent me from finding a device in my house to use to harm myself, attempt to end my life. After 20 to 30 minutes, I'm back to being completely fine again. This is rare, but it's happened a few times. Just chiming in here. Yeah, it sounds pretty classic bipolar schizoaffective. I'm really sorry that you go through. I mean, that is just horrible, not only just in the moment, but also to worry that that could happen at any moment, which is another reason why I really hope that you are working closely with your team and that you have a lot of support around you, people that can be with you in those moments. All right, just going on with Kim's email here. In therapy, I found out that I had a very emotionally absent father and a mother who likely had postpartum depression and heavily favored my older brother. My mother later admitted that she did not have a bond with me as a child. So just chiming in here. Yeah, that's awful. I'm so sorry you went through that. You deserved so much better from your parents. Just going on here with the end of the email, Kim says, I wonder if I have schizotypal personality disorder. I don't experience psychosis every day anymore. Schizoaffective disorder doesn't seem to fit anymore. Medications have never made much difference for me. Therapy has only helped minimally. Just chiming in here. Yeah, I mean, it's possible that the medications weren't dialed in well enough, but that does start to look more towards a personality disorder version of schizotypal. Is it possible that you had a celiac-induced psychosis and you also have schizotypal? Yeah, I mean, maybe that would be one way of conceptualizing it, but there's a lot of schizoaffective in there as well. Anyway, going on. I don't understand how human relationships work. I only have friends that I made prior to my psychotic break, and none of them live near me. I don't understand how or why anyone would initiate relationships without starting guidelines or meaning. It feels very odd. Anytime I try, I cannot get myself to make the bare minimum effort needed to create and maintain friendships, no matter how much I try to beg myself to alleviate my loneliness. Just chiming in here. Yeah, so you wonder, is it schizoid? But then you hear loneliness, which indicates that Kim wants to have friendships, but is struggling with that. Going on. I am extremely confused by human sexuality and romantic relationships. How or why people find another person attractive, how people can tolerate emotional and physical intimacy without feeling smothered, how human beings seem naturally wired towards pairing up. To me, pairing up with someone seems like a disappointing, too predictable outcome. Yet I have tremendous romantic needs that have never been met and probably never will. I find it painful that for some reason I will never fit the mold. Just chiming in here. So what Kim is saying is there's tremendous romantic needs, but just a seeming massive confusion about how or why or how you sustain or how you even tolerate the downsides of being close to someone. Also seems like there's a sensation issue, some sort of sensitivity to being physically close to people, which I, you know, maybe there's a neurodivergence issue there. Hard to know. Going on, but you know, schizotypal individuals will report this for sure. Going on, almost every piece of clothing I wear has either glitter, sequins, rhinestones, rainbow colors, and other flashy stuff. I wear stuff like this every day, even at work, where it might not be appropriate, despite being 34 years old. I also wear very expensive, not particularly natural looking wigs after losing my hair a few years ago. Just chiming in here. I'm really sorry you lost your hair. I mean, that can, for women, just be extremely inconvenient. But sometimes, you know, you make lemonade out of lemons. It's like you get a chance to watch a lot of, you get a chance to wear a lot of interesting wigs. And every day it's like a new fun look. I mean, I don't know your experience. But the first part of this where you're talking about you wear inappropriate, you say, you know, you wear things that are not appropriate at work. Yeah, that's a hallmark of people with schizotypal for sure. Going on. I'm extremely socially awkward, especially when I feel anxious and struggle to speak eloquently. I think my father has schizotypal personality disorder as well, but he is less impaired than I am. His symptoms showed up in being hyper-religious. There's lots of stories there that I won't get into. He has never been overtly psychotic. It's just part of his personality that we've had to get accustomed to. End of email. Yeah, so, you know, your current presentation is definitely, you know, potentially conceptualized or labeled as schizotypal. And it doesn't necessarily matter too much. It just matters what your team how they conceptualize you. Do they understand the full picture that you're going through? You know, because another way of conceptualizing you is that you have a mild version of schizophrenia, or your schizoaffective is in remission, sort of, and you are experiencing some of the symptoms of schizoaffective. And then you also have a dash of schizotypal. I don't know. There's just, I'm glad you wrote in with the details here, because for the listeners right now, for y'all listening, you hear the overlap, the Venn diagram between schizotypal, schizoaffective, bipolar, ADHD. You might even hear some signs of neurodivergence and autism spectrum in there. And you're just like, what do we call this exactly? And then the celiac issue, you're thinking, well, was it ever schizoaffective or was it some sort of medically induced psycho? You know, what are we talking about? And this is a common scenario. Now, some people fit extremely neatly into particular labels. Yeah, I've worked with people who had psychotic bipolar that were just textbook cases. So it, you know, some people do, but a lot of people don't. And what label do we put to it? Yeah, it's important to try to figure it out, because if it is schizotypal, then it doesn't lend itself necessarily to meds. If it is schizoaffective or schizoaffective in remission, then meds are extremely important to stay on top of and to dial in well. If it's a personality disorder, there's more need for trauma work and that sort of. You know, the other thing that you could be looking at, Kim, is that you had schizoaffective, it's in remission, but there's still some symptoms that sort of pop up now and then. And you have disorganized attachment, or a pretty significant version of insecure attachment that makes it really hard to interact with other people. That could be characterized as schizotypal, but it could also just be characterized as insecure attachment reactivity. You know what I mean? So if I were working with you, and I've worked with clients like you, I never feel extremely satisfied with the set of labels that I am applying in the file for the individual. But if I dial in the conceptualization tailored to the individual and start experimenting and trial and erroring various different therapy modalities over a number of months, I usually land in an area where I feel like we're on the right track. Regardless of the fact that I don't feel very confident in a definitive label for the client, if that makes any sense. So it's really important to have someone that phenomenologically understands the big picture for you and reacts to you in a way that actually has positive outcomes. But I'm really glad that you're able to look at this and you have a lot of self-awareness, and you're connected with clinicians that are helping you. You're in therapy, you're talking to a variety of medical professionals. And, usually when people are in that situation, over time, the outcomes tend to be better because you can get a variety of different opinions and you can experiment with different things. The key, though, is, Kim, that you have... you try to cultivate some relationships in your life, because one, you need that, obviously, but also it can really help with safety, right? If you come home from work and you fall into a fetal position and someone's there, they can just be with you, right? And just make sure that everything's okay so that you aren't isolating and going down a downward spiral of suicidal thought, which, you know, is something to be concerned about. Or at the very least, you have people you can call and they come over. I don't know. So, some sort of safety net there, which I'm guessing you've talked about with your clinicians, is important. All right. Well, that does it for that deep dive on schizotypal. Let me know what you think. I don't know if I'm going to necessarily do a full follow-up email episode to this, but definitely if you have thoughts or your own experiences, I would love to hear from you. You know, maybe I'll integrate some of those emails into just a more general episode where I respond to emails or something. I'm sure that some of you have experiences that you'd like to share, or you're thinking, what about my uncle? I think maybe, you know, I think when we start looking at real situations, it helps to clarify our understanding and conceptualization and detection of this disorder. And also let me know what you think of how I'm separating what I believe to be the mild schizophrenia version or mild schizoaffective version versus the personality disorder version. You know, maybe I'll change my mind over time. I do that sometimes with this, but that was one of the ideas that emerged as I was doing this deep dive. I just really had a hard time, and it could just be a product of the way I see personality disorders, how I see them so schema-based. You know, you sit me next to another expert in personality disorders, and we're going to talk very differently. You know, another expert might be very genetically oriented, maybe very biologically oriented, where they might contend that someone with borderline could literally just be born with borderline, and that parents could do everything perfectly and it might not have anything to do with the fit or match between the parents' parenting style and the kid. that the kid just, you know, emerged with the massive genetic sensitivity or risk of developing borderline, and it just happened. You'll hear clinicians talking about it that way sometimes, and researchers. I just don't see it that way. I've never experienced that before. Now, do I have solid, concrete data to demonstrate that my way of understanding personality disorders is correct? No, because it's all retrospective, historical data that we take from clients. Sometimes we can ask family members about early childhood experiences, or sometimes there'll be some sort of record of the mistreatment, but usually not, right? Usually we're asking a client, what was it like when you grew up? And the client who has a disorder and a perceptual disorder claims that they went through abuse growing up. And you could imagine that someone who was born with a perceptual problem or some sort of break from reality that wasn't full-blown like psychosis might interpret or remember their past in a distorted manner, in a way that never actually happened. So, you know, it's all just squishy psychology mind work. but it is a philosophical question with a lot of implications for how we categorize, how we talk about these things, how we research them, and how we treat them. You know, this is how I operate. And that's what I found to be a helpful model of thinking when I'm working with people with schizotypal and other personality disorders. Otherwise, why would we call them a personality disorder, in my opinion? Like, if it's mild schizophrenia, then why aren't we talking about it as a psychotic disorder, just a mild psychotic disorder? Like, why is it even in the chapter called personality disorders? But anyway, so if you have any ideas about that, I'd love to hear your thoughts, because my thoughts are fairly just rattling around in my own head without any kind of sounding board. So let me know what you think. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, especially you, Kim, patron Kim from Arizona. Take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.